think you still have to go by the evidence because there is nothing else. I mean, what I want, what they want, doesn't come into it. It is what the police have found, what the science has found, what the evidence is. And that's all you can go on.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, victim advocate, analyst, founder and director of Paladin, National Stalking Advocacy Service, and co-creator and co-producer of CBS's show, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey. And with me today is...
Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on Criminal Minds, and also co-creator and producer on The Case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
So our listeners will remember that our last pod, we talked about Meredith Kircher, and we tried to bring her character really to life, the type of person that she was, and understanding how she lived in her last few months in Perugia in Italy.
I really paint the picture of her and really bring her to the focus of our talk.
Yeah. And a key part of that was using John Kircher's book, Meredith, Our Daughter's Murder and the Heartbreaking Quest for the Truth, which we would highly recommend our listeners read that, because it's forming really the arc of our discussion points. In the case of Meredith Kircher, the murder of Meredith Kircher, I should say. And we talked about just some of the questions that the family still have and what remains for them. And we feel it's an important part of what we do, obviously, to have the victim's voice in there, but also to listen very carefully to the family and their continuing plight and the fact that they feel that there are still very big questions here about what happened and who ultimately was responsible for sexually assaulting and murdering their daughter, their sister, their loved one. So we raised a number of questions, and the Real Crime Profile team really felt it was useful to highlight the key points of the family. So we're going to start off really talking about the crime scene itself, the forensics and the behavioural analysis. And Jim Sees spent quite a lot of time looking at this case historically. Certainly for me, yes, I was very much present and aware of the case unfolding. And I've spent a longer time, as has Lisa, more recently going back into lots of different sources of information. For me, primarily John's book, but also watching various footage, things like the crime scene video, which is a really important part of understanding what happened, but also about evidence collection. So one of the things that people talk about a lot, certainly on Twitter, and those who know this case talk about the bloody footprints that were found. And people will recall that there was some small traces of blood in the sink, but there are also footprints that were found on the bath mat, and luminol was used, and there was evidence presented that a mixed profile of Amanda Knox and Meredith Kircher's blood was found. And John Kircher and the family really felt that this was significant evidence of guilt. What do you think about that, Jim C?
Well, there was absolutely no footprint that was found of Amanda's that had Meredith's DNA in it. It didn't happen. So if that's what you're asking me, they're saying that had a mixed profile of both Amanda and Meredith?
Yes.
Well, somehow Amanda's blood was
mixed.
No.
See, Amanda lived in the apartment, so
yes,
all over the floor,
sure,
of the apartment is going to be Amanda's DNA. Now somebody else comes in, kills Meredith in a room, comes out and tracks her blood around. That's going to be on top of DNA from all of the girls, women who lived there, many of the visitors that came in, people that were there, you know,
innocently,
months before, innocently, yes.
And this is the challenge around, you know, yes, you've got...
You can't date DNA unless it has a specific purpose. In other words, if you know that a person came into Perugia for the first time in their life on that particular day and had enough time to get from the airport to drive to Perugia and then get out of their car and come upstairs and go there. If you know that, and then they left and there was exactly enough time for them to get back to the airport, then you could date the time that they put that DNA there. But it's there until it's moved. It's there until it's transferred to somebody else. But if that, if a person steps in that apartment one time and I happen to stoop down and wipe my hand across the floor where they step barefoot, I have now transferred some of their DNA to my hand. I can go into my car and touch the steering wheel and transfer it there. If that's a rented car and somebody else rents that car and it wasn't cleaned off thoroughly, they can actually transfer that DNA and bring it to their house. Now you have a person who's never been at their house who left their DNA at your house, or a second person or a third person or a 30th person's house. Transfer DNA is microscopically small. That, let me say that again, microscopically. And that means that there is no way you can see whether it's there or not. Before we get into all the forensic analysis here and the behavioral analysis here, I think it's really important to note that the first criminal trial, the one where they went through all the forensic evidence the first time, was actually a year long. In order for us to actually do that, it would take us a year to go through all the evidence that was presented. We cannot do this in the confines of this podcast. So what we're going to have to do is discuss some generalities and then try to answer questions as they come up in a finite way.
Trying to use what the family have as their main points of questions and concerns. And we're going to use their voice, as Jim C. quite rightly said, because there's so much overwhelming evidence in this particular case. And so, you know, certainly the footprints is one thing that came into it. And I think, you know, what you've said is absolutely right, Jim, in that it would be, you know, ridiculous to think that the DNA from those who were living in this particular villa would not be present, particularly when they're sharing a bathroom together. So you would expect DNA of all of them to be in the sink, on the carpet, on the mats, etc. We're going to talk more about the specifics of the forensics in terms of the bra clasp that was found days later, the knife that was allegedly used to kill Meredith Kircher that was recovered from Raffaele Selecito's apartment, and sort of the main key points that the family have around, you know, the things that the prosecution put and built their case around. And certainly the footprints were one of those things. So absolutely, this transfer issue, and we've seen it in many of the cases, and certainly this CSI effect, as I've called it, as have many other people called it, where somebody's DNA, it being present, does not necessarily mean to say that they are the killer. And so how evidence is collected, how it's assessed, how it's analysed, by whom and when, amongst what other samples that are collected and what it's put by, even in a lab, you know, the whole chain of
custody
in terms of exhibits, all of those things are incredibly important in a case like this, aren't they, Jim?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it will make or break a case. And in this case, it broke the case because they did not actually collect the evidence properly. One thing they did fairly decently and to their detriment in the end, to the detriment of their case or supposed case, was that they did a crime scene video that shows their inept collection methodologies. Not only inept, but clearly contaminating the crime scene by, one, putting on crime scene clothing and gloves and booties outside the room, walking in and across and around and over bloodstains that they did not see out in the hallway. They walked in and then walked around the room further and then walked out and walked back in the room and walked to other rooms without ever changing those booties.
So normally they would be changing constantly. Is that what you're
changing
saying?
Changing the boots, required, changing the gloves.
Yes.
And everything you touch.
Anytime you touch, you change the gloves. Anytime you pick something up with a tweezer, you change the tweezer. You don't use it over again. One of the good things about the show, The Fall, if you recall, Laura, one of the crime scenes that they arrived at, not only were they wearing booties and suits and masks and hair nets and all that kind of stuff, or hair covering and gloves, but they put little stands around the room that they could walk on. So they weren't actually touching the surface of the floor with their booties. And that is one of the things that we do in forensic, in proper forensic collecting of evidence, especially when you have a bloody crime scene. What they didn't realize until much later is that they were walking all over the footprints that led from the bedroom out the front door in sneakers that Rudy Gede owned, that he had that same type of sneaker that left the pattern that was leaving the house. Also, there's a footprint in the bath mat. And I think that's the one that really gave Amanda, like, what's going on here? And she actually thought, well, maybe her roommate had had her period, and that's why there was blood on the bath mat. It may look like a footprint to everybody now because we know it is, but it, maybe it looked like that to her and maybe it didn't. But it did raise some sense of alarm, but not enough. It didn't scare her enough to where she left the house at that point. One thing that made her scratch her head was, why are there no towels in this bathroom? Usually there's towels in the bathroom. There were probably towels in the bathroom when she left the apartment, you know, early, the day before. But she went to the other front bathroom to get the hair dryer, and while she was using that, she noticed the feces in the toilet. And that scared her because she thought, nobody that I live with would leave this here. Somebody else was in here. Oh my God, was that other person in there when I was in the shower? And that scared her. She immediately grabbed a mop because back at Raffaele's, they had a leak, and she was going. That was one of the things she came to the apartment to get, which was a mop to try to clean up the mess in his kitchen. He did not have a mop.
This is a water pipe that had burst,
broken under the sink, right?
Yes.
And she also said that she was holding it like a weapon, like a defensive weapon, like in case somebody just jumped out of the shadows or went behind a door or behind one of the corners, even as she was leaving the place. And she didn't realize that until later. But this bath mat footprint was a bloody footprint, but it was a mixture of blood and water. And many people say that they then took prints from Raffaele Sletchito and Rudy Gede. And one of the prosecution's experts said that the width of the big toe and the size of the foot matched Raffaele's. The problem was that what he measured as the width of the big toe was actually the big toe and the second toe together. Because this is not a complete footprint, remember. This is what part of the foot that left this had also stepped in blood before. In other words, if you take a perfect pool of blood that's bigger than your foot and you put your whole foot into it and it drenches your whole foot and then you stepped on a bath mat, you would leave probably a good solid footprint in blood of your foot. But if the pattern on the floor was not completely the same exact size as your foot and did not cover all the areas of your foot, then you would leave a partial bloody footprint on the mat if that's the next thing you stepped on. And it appears that's what happened. And when you look at Raffaele's footprint, his standard footprint when they actually took it forensically, and then you match it against the print that was left in blood and water on this mat, you'll see that the big toe that was left on the mat is actually a combination of a big toe and the second toe, which is snugged up right next to it. And when you match that against Raffaele's footprint, you'll find that actually his big toe is much wider than the big toe in the mat footprint, and his second toe is kind of popped up, squished between the first and the third, the big toe and then the second smaller toe. The one right next to the big toe is kind of popped up, and it doesn't actually make a print the way this mat has a print right there next to the big toe. And so that in and of itself rules out Raffaele as the donor of that footprint. But there was a lot of contention because the guy who measured it measured both the big toe and the toe next to it and said, that's 30 millimeters, exactly the same width as Raffaele's. I'll show you guys what the actual determination that was made after the erroneous determination was made by the prosecution's expert, who said that the big toe on the bath mat was actually 30 millimeters wide. The fact is that the width that he measured was way up towards the top of the toe, and that was actually both the big toe and the toe next to it, and he measured the complete width there. And the person, the expert that I'm referencing is Francesco Vinci, and his report, his forensic report shows that...
And this is available online, so people can Google it. And so Jim C. now talking it through, you can Google it, find it, and have Jim's narrative.
Yeah, and so you can see that the actual footprints on the mat, and they're not all visible to the naked eye. They've also used science to actually pull out some of the non-visible blood that was left there to show that. And then you can compare it to both Rudy Guede's actual footprint that they took with ink and Raffaele Sollecito's footprint that the police officers took with ink. And you can see that Raffaele's big toe is much wider than the toe that print that's left on the bath mat, and it rules him out. A lot of people also say that the print from the mat is actually too long to match Rudy Guede's foot, but what they don't realize is this is not a full footprint of anybody's foot that's
so
on the
not
mat.
Not complete.
It's a partial print that was left on this mat, and it is and so you can't judge the entire length of this partial print by just seeing the part that was actually left on the mat. So the fact is that it's sad, but by misinterpreting what the evidence that was actually there, I believe that the prosecution's expert misled people in the first trial. Of course, when the ultimate Supreme Court decision came out, this was part of the evidence that they ruled was not properly presented in the first trial. I mean, the evidence later that was presented that refuted the prosecution's interpretation of this forensic evidence was actually upheld in the final judgment that cleared Raffaele Sollecito and Amanda Knox.
Can you explain really briefly why there would be a bare footprint or a sock or a foot with a sock on it footprint in this mat at all?
So we're going to get into some very graphic things here as we discuss this. And I apologize. I apologize to the family and I apologize to people who are not used to talking about this kind of stuff. But the wounds that were inflicted on Meredith Kircher were very bloody and obviously terminal. And when someone is disorganized, so that's one of the things we're going to talk about, there are aspects of organization in this crime, and there are aspects of disorganization.
And criminal sophistication that can go with that.
Right. So there's criminal sophistication and organization in the burglary aspect of this case, and there is a complete lack of criminal sophistication in the rape homicide. Those two things are borne out in many different ways throughout the course of this crime. This did not happen in 1 second or 1 minute. This was a dynamic crime scene. There was a lot of movement. There was struggling. There was fighting. And there was a lot of bleeding that happened. At some point...
Just to say, there were over 40 injuries on Meredith's body. And some of them were stab wounds. Some of them were puncture wounds. It was believed that her throat was also slashed as well, and she had a lot of bruises, a lot of marks on her. So as Jim said, you know, this is a very graphic, upsetting crime scene, as all of them are. But when victims are non-compliant and struggling, then it can lead, you know, the person who is the assailant to use much more force. And that's what we believed happened in this particular case. So the victimology aspect, probably John Kircher was absolutely right in his assessment of Meredith, that she did fight for her life. And the defensive wounds, which we'll talk about, also showed that too.
The way to determine what actually happened in that room that caused Meredith's death and the sexual assault and the subsequent post-defense behavior is by doing a crime scene reconstruction. And by looking at how blood pattern evidence was documented, and by looking at the trajectory of blood spatter and the type of blood spatter and blood smears, that can be accomplished. By all accounts, the assault most likely occurred on the edge of Meredith's bed, close to the wall. That's towards the head of the bed. And I say this because the blood spatter that is on the frame of the bed indicates that at some point the mattress was pushed back a little bit. Blood spattered onto the frame and through the slats of the frame onto the floor in a straight down dripping manner. That is in the same location where there's a handprint, and I believe it's Meredith's, on the wall, kind of streaking downward. That indicates to me that that must have been the first attempt to control Meredith, and when the first stabbing or early stabbing occurred. It had to have been stabbing that produced a lot of blood, because clearly, by the evidence, she put her hand on that stab wound or stab wounds in order to stop the blood flow, and then shortly after that, put that same bloody hand onto the wall and it slipped downward. Whether that was because she lost consciousness or he overpowered her at that point, I don't know, but the battle continued, because on the floor, there's a number of different blood smear patterns and blood spray patterns and aspiration blood patterns, as well as fingerprint, bloody fingerprint patterns on the inside of the armoire.
And that's the inhalation of blood in her lungs, isn't it?
Right. So the gaping wound was sufficiently deep enough that it infiltrated the breathing apparatus, the trachea. I don't know if it's above or below where those, because of the placement on the upper side of under her neck, I don't know where it was exactly on her body. I don't have the autopsy report in front of me right now. But it obviously infiltrated that because she aspirated blood into her lungs. And we know this because of the aspirative spray of blood onto the side of the armoire and to the floor, and onto her bra as well. That shows that this occurred after she was stabbed and after the trachea was infiltrated. So it gives us some indication of the timing of certain events. I've heard people claim that after Meredith was murdered, that that the offender staged it to look like a rape by then pulling off her pants and panties and pushing up her shirt. The problem is that if that were the case, you would not have had, if she had already been dead, you would not have had that blood spatter on her bra. I mean, that must have happened before, at some point before she aspirated that blood onto it. So there are a number of things, and there's a lot of gory detail, and I don't think we need to get into all the gory detail here. The point is, I just don't want to drag everybody through all that, but the point is that it was a long, drawn-out fight. She definitely did fight. She has defensive wounds. She has bruises on her elbows and her hip and her leg and her neck.
And it was believed that she was throttled or strangled before she was stabbed as well, which, again, is a common thing, you know, in trying to, an offender trying to gain control and then using a weapon to...
And many times offenders will try to use a weapon to threaten in order
gain
to control.
Compliance quickly. Right.
But if that doesn't actually cause the person, the victim, to be compliant, then they will sometimes be forced to use it.
And there were some marks on her neck which showed that the knife point had been on her neck, you know, in a potential sort of threat to her.
Right.
So the elements, you know, everything looks like he was the person who was attacking her was trying to gain control that way, and right. yet she was fighting back.
Fighting.
So
exactly.
within
Even
a
after.
Struggle, it becomes chaotic, and that's where it becomes very dynamic, and it's not as clinical as people would think.
Right. What I believe happened is that there were two other parallel cuts, not deep cuts, but just indicative of holding a knife, a sharp knife, against somebody's neck and somebody struggling. And so there are two parallel type cuts there, just not, I mean, surface cuts, and then a deep penetrating wound to the throat. And it is a slashing type wound, but it is possible that the knife, after it slashed, also went into that same wound in the same, you know, motion, as well as other penetrating wounds where that were stab wounds into the neck. So it may have been that he was holding the knife against her throat, and he held it there. She was struggling against it. It cut her a little bit. It cut her a little bit again in a slightly different location. And then when he wasn't getting her under control, he pulled it back and slashed across her throat, and then also pushed the knife inside and cut into her trachea, and that's why she aspirated the blood. So I'm sorry.
So there is a lot of blood in this particular crime scene versus others that we have seen where there isn't any, and therefore
right.
the person who attacked her would have also had a fair amount of transfer in terms of blood on them too.
Yes, and I mean, it shows that there wasn't a lot of control of the victim. And to me, that indicates less than a number of offenders, a single offender, because if there were multiple offenders, control would have been gained easily. Control would have been immediate, overwhelming, and there would not have been any need to have the kind of struggle that's evidenced in this crime scene. I think that cuts absolutely against any theory that there were multiple offenders here, but that's just on that one level. There are multiple other levels that we'll go into about why I believe, you know, for example, behaviorally, why I believe that there is no indication in this crime scene that there's multiple offenders. But let's go back to the bloody crime scene. Because of all this blood would have gotten onto the offender. There's just no question about it. It can't be
close contact crime of this nature using a weapon. It, you know, sadly, it is up close and personal, and it is wet work, as
right.
we would call it.
And there are divergent theories about whether the sexual assault slash rape occurred at this point or after the offender got up and went to the bathroom and got the towels from the bathroom and basically pushed blood away, left two towels on the floor, put down a pillow on the floor over those towels, and Meredith's hips on top of the pillow, and one of the towels ended up on top of the bed. It's not clear whether he was using that to wipe off his hands or his clothes or his shoes, whatever it was. But at some point, there's certainly evidence of a sexual assault. What's not certain is whether or not it was a rape or a digital penetration sexual assault. What is evident is that Rudy Gede left his skin cells inside the vagina of the victim. That may have been through penile penetration. It may have been through digital penetration. What's also evident is that on that pillow, at the area of the apex of her legs, there is a stain that has been identified as a biological semen stain, and the prosecution refused to test that stain. It's unconscionable, it's absurd, and I'll go as far as saying it's idiotic. I have never seen a case in which a sexual assault occurred and the prosecution failed to test any biological stain that was left at the scene. They claim that they did that because they wanted to protect Meredith's honor.
Well, actually, they claimed, because I looked at this again, and I was very curious, you know, it was very interesting, and I was very curious about why they would make that decision. And certainly, it was Raffaele Sollecito's lawyer who requested that sample be tested. And the reason, and I heard it through the prosecutor, was that they felt that, you know, because Meredith had a boyfriend, that it was probably, it belonged to the boyfriend, therefore it had no relevance.
Feeling and probably have case. No relevance in a court of law. In a criminal case, in a murder case, it's absurd. It's insane. I cannot believe that they actually put that forward as a legitimate excuse for not testing that semen. It's just outrageous.
Well, this goes back to, doesn't it, picking and choosing the things that you want to try and prove and ignoring the type and nature of this particular crime. Everything should have been tested and there should have been no judgment made about what was relevant, and particularly a semen stain on the pillowcase, irrespective of whether she had a partner or not a partner. It absolutely should have been tested. But I thought it was a very interesting statement from the prosecution. It made it very clear to me that things were being picked and chosen in a way that was trying to go down a certain route at times.
Fit their theory.
To fit their theory. And, you know, one of our experts, somebody called Peter Gill, who has been a forensic expert for 30 years, also said a very similar thing, that he certainly found that very disturbing. And very, very concerning that it wasn't tested.
But it's beyond disturbing and interesting and concerning. It is absolutely wrong. You do not do that in this case. And there is absolute proof that it isn't her boyfriend's. If it were, then you would find, when they swabbed her vaginal area and found Rudy Gede's skin cells in there, they would have also found the boyfriend's skin cells in there. And if they didn't find that, he couldn't have transported his semen over there. The only way it could have gotten there is if it was in her and it came out on that scene. And that, although that's possible, there's one way to determine whether that happened or not. And did they or did they not find his skin cells in her vagina as well? I mean,
Well, this is where evidence has clearly been selected to fit the suspects that they had in mind.
It's unconscionable.
But even hearing the rationale for it makes no sense. It's incredibly bizarre that they even answered that question. So it just throws up the whole evidential collection process. And as we know, you know, we'll talk about the bra clasp in particular, because this was another significant part to this case, as well as the knife. You know, we saw, as you mentioned, Jim C., with the crime scene video, which actually was something that was incredibly helpful to be able to see how they were doing things and the particular methods that were used. But to find that bra clasp days later tells us that the scene wasn't done thoroughly in the first place, full stop.
Right, absolutely.
They didn't do a good job to start with.
Not only thoroughly.
The thing I was going to say was just about the latex gloves, because I think that this is another very interesting point, is that there's a very high risk of transfer with latex gloves. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that from that crime scene video, and we talked about it in the other pod, that the bra clasp is handed around different people who are at the crime scene.
By the clasp.
Yes, actually holding the clasp itself, not using tweezers. But it's dropped on the floor as well. So we then have other transfer of it being moved around, etc. But we also know, and just to point out, that the people who are in the home address, so those individuals before the police and before everyone's called, well, they're going to be trying to get into the home address using door handles, etc., and touching everything. So things like, you know, if there's a high transfer just with the latex gloves, well, there's also every likelihood Raffaele, by his own admission, opened the door using...
Tried to open the door, yeah.
Well, I'm talking about the front door, actually.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You've got the front door that everyone's opening using their naked hands with no gloves. And then you've got those who are trying to open Meredith Kircher's door as well. And
Raffaele
Selecito was one of those people trying to get in there.
And he had been at the apartment before.
Right, so of course he's going to have his DNA.
He's going to leave his DNA on the floor.
He's made lunch for them.
Right, remember, they walked into the room, stepping on the footprints that are outside, stepping on anybody else's DNA deposits there. And then days later, they find the bra clasp that was pictured in the original search, but not collected in the original search. So they go back and find it, but they find it under a scrunched up rug that they had stuffed they threw all sorts of clothing and things from
the room
onto the bed.
Things were in the laundry basket as well.
Then there was a laundry basket. They stuffed the jacket that she had been wearing, which was covered in her blood. They stuffed it into that laundry basket. They stuffed all sorts of things. When they pulled things out and pulled things out from under the bed, they found a bunch of evidence that they didn't realize was relevant at the time. They didn't collect her handbag, for example, with Rudy Gede's bloody fingerprints on. Where her
had a palm print on it.
Yeah. And so all that all that evidence was still there. But when they collected the bra clasp, it's actually made of cloth. And it has a metal clasp on it. And they actually picked it up in the crime scene video by the metal clasp, handed it from one person to another and then back, and then they threw it on the floor and then photographed it as if that was how it was found to make it look like that's where it was found. Well, when they threw it back on the floor, they certainly put it in a different place than where they just picked it up. And so now all these people have come in to that room, tracked in, whatever DNA was out in the hallway and the entryway of that and the bathroom, everywhere in that apartment, tracked it into the crime scene room, and now you're throwing this bra clasp, which is made of metal and cloth, onto a floor and re-photographing.
When we come back, we're going to circle back to the bloody footprints because there's more for us to discuss on that.
As far as the bra clasp is concerned, what happened? This bra clasp was collected 46 days after the first crime scene inspection, and a mixture of biological material was found. There was a profile attributable to the victim, which is normal, and other material that was attributable to Raffaele Sollecito. There were other traces, but they were not attributed to anyone.
So we're back, and Jim C. wants to talk a little bit more about the bloody footprints.
Yeah, I don't think I actually got to the point where I was discussing. The crime scene was very bloody, and of course, if the offender is walking around in that crime scene or kneeling or doing anything in that crime scene, it's close contact crime. He would have gotten blood all over him, including stepping on it. Now, there are a number of bare footprints in blood, and there are a number of footprints in blood that were made by a sneaker. And the ones that there are right outside of Meredith's bedroom, there are two, not very distinguished, but clearly footprints that appear to be bare footprints. One pointing towards the room and one pointing the other way. And then there's the bloody footprint on the mat. The two kind of blob footprints were indistinguishable, but the prosecution claimed that they were Amanda's. And there's not enough distinguishing factors to determine whether they were or were not. But there are footprints from a sneaker that lead from the bathroom from Meredith's room to the front door entrance. They're faint. Nobody knew they were there with the naked eye, but when they used luminol, they came up. So it's clear that the offender went to the bathroom at some point, got towels from there, also made an attempt to clean up. That's why there's blood on the faucet. Of course, we know that Rudy Gede had a cut on his hand, so that's a reason why the faucet would have just a couple of drops of blood on it. There's also blood, I believe, in the bidet. It looks like he might have cleaned his sneakers in the bidet or in the sink. But even if he cleans it, luminol, we should talk about this. So luminol, if he cleaned, let's say he stepped in the blood and went to the bathroom, sort of one foot did not step in the blood, the other foot did. He could basically hop on the clean foot towards the bathroom, then step down on the mat with the bloody foot. But even if he cleaned his sneakers, apparently he attempted to clean the sneakers because it wasn't visible blood, but luminol can pick up such tiny traces of blood that even though it wasn't visible to the eye, we could see that he must have put his shoes back on, his sneakers back on, and walked towards the front door, and that's how he left. So, that and he left the front door without locking it. It was open when Amanda returned. So, it's clear that he made an attempt that wasn't forensically sophisticated. He did not understand that even though he wiped the or even ran water over his sneakers, that it didn't get all the blood off of it, and that he didn't expect to leave a trail like that. But it also shows that the crime scene investigators were just as forensically unsophisticated, because they didn't even prepare for that possibility. The only room that they really were concerned about was Meredith Kircher's room, and not the entire hallway and the kitchen area and the other rooms. It's unfortunate, but they trampled all over this evidence, and the evidence that we have is contaminated.
But it's still evidence nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we know that it was, you know, the evidence and the crime scene was mishandled, but there's still some very clear evidence. And,
sure.
You know, my view is that there was an attempt at a cleanup, because given how much blood there would be in a crime like this, whoever it is, and, you know, we've talked specifically about who it is, they've got to leave the house at some point.
Right.
And therefore, if they've got blood transferred onto them, they're going to be conscious of that, even though it's dark, mm-hmm. When they're leaving. So, you know, we know, for example, that there was a blue sweatshirt that was left at the crime scene that was folded up and sort of, or scrumpled up and put in the laundry basket.
By the police.
Yeah, but that actually had Grady's DNA that was left on the sleeve of it.
Right, and it looked like it was pulled inside out.
Right.
Whose sweatshirt was that?
It was Meredith.
So, okay. Yeah, but things that were in her room, you know, everything should have really been tested full stop, and along with every other room in the house. But, of course, that wasn't done. And the fact that he has got cuts on his hands is very significant, because whoever this was that inflicted these wounds would have had cuts. There's a very high likelihood they would have had cuts on their hands because of the force of, you know, the stabbing. And if we believe that it was this penknife that was used, then that could have been very well the weapon that created those cuts on Guede's hands with the penknife. And we knew that, and it is known that he did carry a knife on him.
Right. And we also know that the knife was used in this crime, because there is a bloody impression of that knife on the bed in Meredith Kircher's blood. So we know that it was there, present at the scene and used. So for the prosecution to then say that this other knife from Raffaele Sollecito's kitchen was actually the murder weapon, it's just fantasy.
It didn't match at all to the print.
No, it didn't. And in the end, they did not find Meredith Kircher's blood on the blade. That was not a legitimate scientific sample that was found, and it was
not a profile of her DNA that was found on
the
knife.
They've actually said that, I mean, I've heard one expert say that it was yeast actually on the knife, it was not anybody's human blood, and that if they did determine that Meredith Kircher's blood was on it, that it was such a minute sample that it must have been from contamination.
I don't know if this is jumping ahead, but I have a couple questions, so tell me if...
Okay.
I mentioned before, so the towels that were found in Meredith's room, you know, full of blood, I just can't get my mind around why he would bring the towels in and try to clean up when there's no way he can clean up everything, and what is, you know, he can't get rid of her body, so that idea that he's bringing the blood in to clean up the floor, it just seems odd. I can understand him using the towels to clean himself off, but bringing it in to sop up the blood, it just seems odd. So,
well, again, I mean, when you look at the crime scene photos and the actual crime scene video, and of course the video was leaked online at some point, and I want to return to that because I think that's a very interesting point, but, you know, we sit and we have a very rational conversation about these things. That's not normally what happens when a crime like this occurs. The offender doesn't necessarily plan through every part of it. And you have to remember what fantasy and reality are two very different things. And in this particular case, and we'll talk specifically about this, you know, it's my opinion and my belief that this wasn't something that was thought through from beginning to end. And again, this wasn't something that even when there is blood everywhere, that it's a conscious decision to try and clean everything up in terms of what's in the room, but also on himself, if we talk about Guede specifically. So I actually think it was an attempt more to clean him up before he left, and maybe, you know, a quick flip round the room. But you can see actually from the crime scene pictures, there's no real attempt to clean up the crime scene full stop. Or, you know, the only thing that we do see is the duvet that Meredith and it was her family who said that she really wanted a duvet. And actually, it's quite a rare thing in Italy, an actual duvet. But she hunted high and low to find this duvet. And ironically, it's the thing that is, you know, taken off the bed at some point and is used to cover, you know, majority of her body. And that appears really to be the only thing that happens. And of course, two telephones, mobile phones, are also taken from her room at some point. One is a phone that's registered to her. And the other one, I think it was Philomena, gave her a cheap and quick and easy to use phone. That was a local phone, and that was believed to be in Meredith's possession too, and that's what was found in the neighbour's garden, both those two phones.
Her
and
credit
her
cards,
keys,
yeah, and her credit cards. Because I keep
and $300.
Right, I keep reading that nothing was taken. It wasn't a crime of, you know, it wasn't a robbery, but there were things taken. Of
course, it was burglary, yeah.
Right.
And so, yeah, there's a lot of inconsistencies in what happened, and you have to understand this is what shows us that it's criminally unsophisticated, that this is not an organized crime or criminal, and that at this point he was basically thinking on his feet. He's probably panicked. There's no indication that he has done this before. Certainly did not intend to do this at this night.
Well, there's certainly indications that, you know, he's burgled before, burglarized, and, you know, was arrested prior to this, and we'll get onto that. But certainly, as you said, you know, we don't know how many other rapes may have happened, and you don't ultimately know how many murders, but it is disorganized, and he is not criminally sophisticated.
Right. And rape is one of the most underreported crimes, so it's not surprising that he could have raped before.
It's about 12% that are reported of rapes.
Yeah,
and you know, we have two studies that one was done in the state of Washington, and one was done in Canada, that was saying 80% of rapes were not reported. So it's a small percentage that are, and so it's possible that he's done this before and nobody reported it against him, or he just wasn't caught for the rapes that he's done. But be that as it may, the crime scene does not indicate that he is a sophisticated criminal when it comes to rape homicides. And the fact that he may have tried to clean up himself or even parts of the floor could be for practical reasons, that he may have still been engaged in the sexual activity. It may be because he thought, maybe at first he thought he could clean it up and make it look like some kind of accident. I don't know. But he probably wasn't thinking logically. And one of the things I want to add to that is there are witnesses who came forward who said that Rudy Guede at times would exhibit behavior that we would call, you know, indications of psychosis, that he was talking to himself or having conversations with people that weren't there. And so he may have been disturbed that way. I mean, I've seen interviews done of him since then where he's very together.
Absolutely.
Where he presents very well, in fact.
But I don't know what he's like when he's high or drunk or having some kind of psychotic break that he might have. So there's all sorts of different things. You don't impose on him clear logical thinking, especially in a situation like this, because not only is there, you know, an incredible, you know, confusion and fear and excitement and maybe even regret, there's a lot of things competing in his brain at that point.
And how a victim reacts also can change what happens next. And that's not to place any blame on a victim, but sometimes offenders can be more violent because someone is non-compliant. And in other cases where it's a serial case where someone's been compliant, there's no physical violence exerted. So there's lots of dynamics, as we've already talked about, at play. And it's not normally a rational choice. We don't know what state of mind he was in at the time, but we certainly know that it is a very disorganized crime scene. We've got to remember the feces that's in the toilet. So he's not thinking really about forensics or things being left, you know, in a clear mind. But whoever it is, and, it, you know, believing that it's Rudy Guaido, he's certainly thinking that he has to exit the house at some point. Right. And he would probably be thinking about exiting, not being covered in blood and trying to clean up, you know, feet, shoes, items of clothing. Of course, you know, there was a sighting of a black male around the address as well.
Running away. Over somebody on the staircase.
And there's also
a
neighbour, a female neighbour, who also said that she heard a scream, a blood-curdling scream from a female, and she heard one set of footsteps running away. And that was an account from one of the neighbours.
So
it's not a rational decision-making process. And even with those who've ruminated, thought it through, you know, hundreds of thousands of times, the reality and the fantasy are two entirely different things in the blink of an eye.
Can you share with us any other cases that you know of someone who only has done burglary in the past and then suddenly in one night escalates not only burglary but then sexual assault and murder? Because for my untrained mind, I can understand trying to break in somewhere, oh my God, there's a witness, I kill them. Or I can understand breaking in just for sex and I kill them. But to only have been a burglar and then suddenly to become a predator
Well, all we know about is the burglary.
Right.
What we're trying to say is
Rape
is a very underreported crime.
Yeah,
and there is no absolute path for anybody. I mean, you can't say that they only do it this way or that way. It's an individual set of circumstances. It's a complicated mix of bio, psycho, and social factors that come together at any given point that create somebody who would commit a crime like this. And it's only a huge leap if we actually know it's his first time ever sexually assaulting somebody. But it's also, it's the first time that we know of that he broke into the home of people that he knew, that he had met. Even though it was only fleeting, he knew the guys downstairs a lot better than he knew the girls upstairs. Mm-hmm. But he had met Amanda. He had met Meredith at least two different occasions. And so the fact is that if
there's still a question mark about whether he even did break in, you know, did he see her go home, and did he manage to get himself into the address without breaking into it? But that's a question we're going to talk about separately, because I think we should answer this question.
So he's now faced with a situation he's never been in before, where somebody can actually identify him. In a previous burglary that he was identified as having done, he was confronted by a man. He pulls out a knife and gets out of the situation. In another burglary where he came into a nursery school, he was confronted, but basically was not. It was in the morning. It wasn't at the time. Just after his adrenaline would have been all, you know, pulsing through his body because he had just broken in, and so he got out of that one without creating a problem. There was more than one person who confronted him at that point. So now he's in a new situation. He's actually broken into a place where somebody can identify him. He may have panicked and said, I've got to kill this person, otherwise I'm going to go back to jail. Remember, he just got out of jail in Milan 2 weeks before for breaking into a nursery school. And that's a whole other thing we need to talk about later, which is how he got out of jail in Milan and ended up back in Perugia
weeks later.
Knife.
And in fact, he had a knife, as you quite rightly said. And I, just adding to Jim's, I've certainly seen many cases where someone has been a good burglar, and that's what they do. They go into people's houses. Most burglars don't want someone to be present when they go in to take items. But I have seen a number of cases where the perpetrator then sees the opportunity, and if it's a lone female, where rapes have taken place because the opportunity has presented itself and escalation has happened. So in some cases, yes, it has resulted in murder or serious injury. I mean, there's one case I'm thinking of in particular, Operation Minstead, which was a terrible series of elderly ladies being raped in southeast London. And actually, I was involved in this case. I did different stints of 6 months working within the major incident room. Our first DNA-linked case was in 1992, but he had definitely been offending prior to that. But we had hundreds of cases, And, you know, some women didn't come forward, of course, particularly when they're elderly. But in some cases, he would sexually assault. Some cases, he would rape. Some cases, he would just stay in the house and he actually wouldn't do anything. He would spend, you know, a large amount of time in the house. But in one particular case, and again, I don't believe the intention was to harm, but he did seriously harm an elderly lady because she was so frail. And, you know, so the escalation we did see over time. But I think we always have to remember that with offenders, we only know what we know, and we don't know their whole serial pathway and pattern of offending, and they certainly don't tell us that. So it's a misnomer to think that somebody, you know, escalates in a textbook way from, you know, sort of peeping and being a voyeur to then burglary to then to rape to then murder, and then they do murder. Behavior doesn't happen like that.
Right. But in some cases it does. And we do have the benefit in the Behavioral Analysis Unit of having interviewed hundreds and hundreds of these kinds of offenders. And many of them do start with trespass, burglary crimes. When they go into the home, they feel the excitement of being someplace where they're not supposed to be, but they commit a crime in there, that becomes burglary, okay?
But that's a gateway offense. Yes, I mean, in the sense that they don't always do the same. Once they've escalated, they don't do the same thing all of the time.
I know,
it can
right.
be up and down the spectrum.
Absolutely. And all I'm saying is, I'm trying to answer your question that whether or not this guy escalated all in one night, well, we don't know, but I do know, like, for example, the Center City rapist in Philadelphia. He had broken into homes. He had done the peeping and then breaking in and then raping. And then in one case where he was kind of cornered, he killed a woman. And the police were worried in Philadelphia about this guy becoming a serial killer now. And we told them, no, we don't think that's the case. We think he will not kill again unless he is cornered the way he was cornered that night. And sure enough, he went on to rape again, but he did not kill after that. And if Rudy hadn't been caught in this case, he probably would have sexually assaulted or raped other women as he was doing burglaries if they happened to be home. But his preference was to break into a home and to get food and to get money and to get things he could sell quickly and stay there if nobody was around and then go off because he was basically itinerant. He was homeless, basically. And I think also in the Golden State Killer case, he started out as the East Side rapist up in Sacramento, and he raped over 40 or 50 people, women, and then he killed. He moved down south, and he killed, you know, I think 10 people down there. But it's, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that go into this. It's developing your MO, and again, he had, the person who did this, I believe, had a very strong MO in terms of burglary, but didn't have a very strong MO in terms of rape or murder. And I think that came out in his behavior. And I think we see that evidenced in the crime scene, and you would see it in pre- and post-offense behavior as well. So just keep in mind, as Laura said, we only know what we're aware of. Mm-hmm. He has not yet revealed everything about what his sexual development was, what his criminal development was, what he did before and after this crime, because he made statements that are convenient for him so that he could get out of jail early.
There are many inconsistencies, and I think we've always got to remember that when we're, you know, when offenders are caught, even when we look at the timeline of them, you know, we are trying to fill in all that information, but many do not say everything they have done throughout their whole offending career. And actually, some of them, the cases that Jim C and I have worked on together, we've had some offenders who have been so prolific they can't even remember half the crimes that they've committed. Right. But I think, you know, in some cases you have offenders who are targeting very specific victim types. The victimology is very key. Like the case that I talked about with an offender who was very prolific going and targeting elderly women. Some, and that case in particular, would involve a lot of predatory stalking and some of the gateway offences, things that do excite people. But it is a real misnomer to put behaviour and people in rigid categories and think that they behave in a certain way along their continuum, if you like, because that is a real misnomer. It's a very dangerous way to think. I believe with this particular case, he didn't have a well thought out, this is the beginning, middle and end, things unfolded and it was dynamic. And so some of those things people try and explain away in the cold light of day and rationalize it. But he made some decisions in the blink of an eye, and therefore some of it does not entirely make sense.
Mm. I mean, there's a possibility that he burglarized the house, he broke into the house, And he was excited about that. I mean, it is a dangerous situation, and that can cause a fight or flight response. And part of that could be having to use the bathroom. That's happened in a number of cases. And offenders feel the need to defecate as part of that fight or flight response. That could have been going on when Meredith arrived home. And so he would have been surprised and not able to flush the toilet without alerting her. And maybe he just hid there waiting for her to go to bed and thinking then he could sneak out of the house. But what he wouldn't have known, maybe, was the fact that you have to use a key to unlock the front door, that you can't just walk out the front door.
Right, because he'd never been in their apartment before. He'd been downstairs, but he hadn't been in the girl's apartment.
Right, and I don't know
As far as we know, of course.
Right, yeah. But I don't know if downstairs had the same setup with the front door or not. Mm-hmm. But whether it did or didn't, the fact is he could have been trapped in there, not knowing how to get out, and then realizing I'm going to have to confront her in order to get her keys so I can get out of here. But if I confront her, she's going to know who I am. And I believe he made the determination that he was going to try to get rid of her. And that's why this case ended this way. Whether it was maybe he tried to cover his face and it turned out that she recognized him, or maybe some other thing happened that made him realize this is not going to end well and I have to end her life.
Up next, let's talk about the motives. I mean, was this targeted or was it opportunistic?
Lawyers for both defendants say justice has already been done. Drifter Rudy Guaida, already serving 30 years for Meredith's murder, they say acted alone.
So now let's get into the motives. We've already started a little bit of it, Jim C. But, you know, in terms of that night, what was happening was, you know, we know Meredith's last footsteps, but we also know Guaida was on a CCTV camera picked up twice around the villa. So, you know, your view on whether you think this is a targeted or an opportunistic attack?
I think, in my view, that the burglary was a targeted attack. I think that Guaida probably had information that most of the people were not going to be in that cottage that night, and he tossed a rock to smash the window on the second floor to see if any alarms were raised, and then left the area, and since no alarms were raised, he came back in. It reminds me of a bank burglary crew that we had in Queens back in 1987 or 88. And they would do exactly that. They would drive by a bank and they would throw a rock through the window. And what would happen at that point was the alarm would typically go off, and then a company would come and turn off the alarm, and they'd board up the window until the next morning, where it would be officially repaired. But after that company left, then the burglars would come back, take off the wood, go into the bank, knowing that now there was no alarm, and then they would burglarize the bank and then take off. And so we had to sit on, I think for 2 weeks, we staked out six different banks in Queens until we actually got into a car chase. And they got away at that point, but we tracked them down as a result of that. But it's a methodology that's used by burglars because of this day and age that there are so many alarm systems and surveillance systems, that it's a way for them to very low-tech defeat an alarm system. So I think that's what happened with respect to the burglary side of it. I believe that it's possible that Guaida was hoping that Meredith would come back. I think he was probably surprised at the timing of it, but it's also possible that he was completely surprised that she came back to the apartment at all.
Why Meredith and not Amanda, for example? Bearing in mind, or any of the other housemates that lived there.
Well, I think that Meredith would have been the one who didn't have a boyfriend that was in town that night. Amanda did have a boyfriend that was in town that night.
Philomena, she was with her boyfriend, and they were not far away.
And I don't think Laura had a boyfriend.
I mean, in the apartment that night. They were not in the apartment that night.
No, but he probably had no way of knowing that. I mean, I don't know. Well, it's not like she went out of packed her bags and went out of town.
But she stayed with her boyfriend.
Right.
And Amanda stayed with her boyfriend.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And we know that the new guy that Meredith started seeing was not in town.
Right.
So she would have been home alone. If he knew, I'm not saying that he definitely knew about Amanda and Philomena, but that's the fact that they were out staying with their boyfriends. So it's possible that he found out that information from the guys innocently.
I mean, bearing in mind he did know the guys and he had been in their apartment. But I think it's interesting just listening to the villa, you know, description of the villa and this particular window that the rock was thrown up through, because I believe that it was 3 meters high. So it's quite a...
Well, if he threw it from the ground there, there's also a parking area up top. It's a plateau opposite the window that he could have thrown it straight across.
Right, but does he throw, you know, yes, I know that is an MO and that's something that he may well have done, but does he throw the brick, then realize that no one's there, and you believe that he went through that window?
Yes.
Or, which again, you know, it's 3 meters, that's quite, and it's apparently in an area where other people could have seen, you know, it's not the most obvious choice of windows.
Actually, I think the opposite. I think it was down, where he would have to climb, he would have to pull himself up on the lower window, and then with the bars of that window, step on the bottom of the windowsill, and then step up to the top of the windowsill to grab he'd be able to grab the windowsill above and then pull himself up. And
that
go
was demonstrated,
through.
I think, by Raffaele's lawyer was
yeah,
able to actually do it.
He was able to do it as well. And he isn't a young, athletic
right.
guy like Rudy Gede is.
Yeah.
But those are the kinds of indications that we use when we do crime scene reconstruction, that the offender is young and athletic. And this guy, Rudy Gede, who happened to leave his DNA all over and his fingerprints and his palm prints all over this crime scene, happens to be young and athletic.
Well, this was one of, you know, I know something about going through windows and basement
don't
windows,
you?
For example,
right.
which is why I am intrigued by this, because I was listening to a BBC Four report, which was actually very interesting, by Ruth Alexander. And she was at the house at the time of making this report. It's on a podcast, actually, so you can download it and listen to it. But she basically says, and this was part of the prosecution's case, that it was, you know, high up and it was in a place where he would have been seen. But also the prosecution's case was that there was glass shattered on top of, you know, a room, Philomena's bedroom, I believe it was, that had been made to look or had been already ransacked, and there were things everywhere. But the glass was on top of things, and therefore the police and the prosecution felt that this was a staged burglary.
Yeah, well, I mean, I looked at it, Steve Moore looked at it, John Douglas looked at it, and we all said the exact opposite, that, in fact, you're looking at the final result of it, and you don't know what happened in between. Plus, Philomena got in there and took her computer out. That computer was on the floor, and when Amanda and Raffaele went into that room, but you don't know if that when the rock came through the window, how far that glass was spread. I mean, especially if he had to throw it up 3 meters, and it was a pretty hefty rock. That would have been a tremendous amount of force that hit that window. So it can blow out the glass in a bunch of different directions. But let's say it landed on top, some of the glass landed on top of the bed, and then he decided to pull the sheets back on the bed. He can spread that glass somewhere else. If it landed on clothes somewhere or on an item, or if he came through the window, and he could have slipped and knocked things out. And maybe when he got up to the window, he had to punch out different parts of the glass, knock it out with something else. There's a lot of different reasons why that glass could be spread in the patterns. We know that it's not an original crime scene because we know of at least two people who went in there after the rock went through there. One was the person who came through that window, and two was Philomena. But we also know that a number of other people were in there as well. I don't know how Philomena got back in to get her computer, but somehow she did get her computer out of that room.
So your view is that, yes, and we have to remember that other people did go into that room, did take things, did move things, etc. The other point that I was going to make was, or question for you, it was that, so you believe that Guede went through that particular window and was there when Meredith came through the door. He was actually in situ in the house. as she comes home.
Yeah, I do believe that. And one of the reasons I do believe that is I think it's supported by, at the time, unknown evidence. And that is that Rudy Guédé, whose DNA and fingerprints and palm prints and everything and shoe prints were left in the murder room, Rudy Guédé has a history of doing that. He didn't, in the other cases, stage a crime scene to look like a burglary. He committed burglaries in that manner. He threw
and
a rock
that's what it was,
through the
yes.
second floor, and then is it possible that he said after he murdered Meredith Kircher, "I'm going to go outside and make this look like a burglary," when that would point right back to him? A burglary doesn't exonerate him. You would only have to stage it if you were actually somebody who lived in that house. In other words, there's no reason for an actual burglar or somebody who is illegally in there to stage it to look like something that he was actually doing, which is...
Or if you're known. I mean, I just play out all these different hypotheses because I think it's helpful to do it, as okay. we know, in the sense that, you know, he did know the boys who were down on the bottom floor. He had been in that apartment. We know that he had been introduced to Amanda Knox at one point at least, not that she really knew him, mm-hmm. and he may well have seen Meredith, certainly on one occasion, maybe a number of occasions. And, you know, what one of the hypotheses that went through my mind is that the night before they are at a club together, not actually physically together, they're at the same time,
right.
you know, partying with their respective friends. And his lawyer makes that clear, although there's no photos of them together. But, you know, another hypothesis could be that, you know, when we think about, is this targeted, is it opportunistic, that Meredith walks home and we know that he was caught on CCTV twice around the villa, that what if he does just manage to gain access to the property by just knocking on the door? She has seen him before. Of course, his version of events changes, and he actually says that they were dating, she had invited him round, and that he, you know, went there, she opened the door and they started kissing, and then he changes tact of right. what happened. But there is a possibility that he does gain entry and it happens in that way. And then he starts pushing on things and trying to get far more from her, and then things unfold. And given that he is known, he has been seen locally, he plays basketball on the court, he had been introduced, there is a hypothesis that happened. And then potentially he does try and stage it to make it look like it was a burglary and try and clean some things up. And then, of course, we know that he leaves the crime scene, and through other reports, he apparently had cleaned himself up and was in a club that evening dancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the question is, why would a burglar stage it to look like a burglary? So under that theory, then he would have had to ransack the room, Philomena's room, not take the computer, which he's taken in previous burglaries.
But not in this one.
Right,
he didn't take any
one.
Of the laptops in
right.
this.
But the laptop was put on the floor, and which is something that could indicate that he was setting it aside to get back to pick up. But he got interrupted. But anyway, so let's play it out. So now he decides, I'm going to ransack the room and put the laptop on the floor. I want to make it look like a burglary, but I'm not going to take anything outside the room where the murder happened. I'm only going to take things from the murder room, which would then put me in the murder room. And then I'm going to go outside and smash a window so that all this glass then comes on top of the bed and on top of clothes that are ransacked. It just, to me, makes no sense. It's adding a layer of hypothesis on top of what is fact, and that is that he has a history of committing burglaries in this manner. I don't think that anybody, that even if he was known to the victim, that he would exonerate himself by making it look like a burglary, which he has been arrested for in the past. Very recently, okay. actually, 2 weeks earlier.
But of course, he did say that he had been in that house, and that was on the, I believe, the Facebook messages when he's first questioned about it. When the police start asking him, you know, pretending that they're the friend, he does actually say he had been in the house, and that's why they would expect to find his, you know, his DNA or forensics there. He'd already kind of covered off that base, and you know, as we know, and why, you know, I think it's something worth discussing is that, you know, in the blink of an eye and under pressure, people do strange things that he may not just be thinking as clearly as, well, this kind of would implicate me even more to stage it, make it look like a burglary. He actually might think he's diverting it even further away from him because this is a sex crime, not a burglary. Do you see what I mean?
That I it's do not see as... what you mean. But I, you know, it goes to his ignorance and his lack of criminal and forensic sophistication to say, to tell the police that he was in there and that he was just there, you know, on a date and then comforting her, and then he got surprised by somebody who attacked him with a scalpel-type knife, and you know, man.
When he'd been sat in the bathroom before that listening to three music songs, which would have taken 10 minutes, and all of this convoluted.
This stuff. But yet he leaves a bloody palm print on the purse where Meredith's credit cards, keys, and I don't know if her keys were necessarily in there, but her credit cards and $300. And what else was taken from there?
Well, the two phones were taken,
Two phones. And so it's just an indicator of how criminally unsophisticated and forensically unsophisticated he was, that he thought that this story that he came up with, which is completely inconsistent with the facts, the evidence that's there, and much more consistent with somebody who is trying after the fact to cover his tracks. We haven't started talking about behavioral evidence as well, but, you know, obviously when we get to the behavioral evidence with respect to Meredith as well as with respect to Rudy Guede and Amanda and Raffaele, all that I think will also add another layer of argument against Rudy staging that burglary. I think that especially because there's a dead body in that apartment, that he would not spend extra time in order to make it look like something else when that something else was exactly what he was arrested for just 2 weeks earlier.
Interesting. And I think, you know, this shows us that we have far more to discuss. Yes. And I think we definitely need to come back to this point,
definitely.
Because I still would like to revisit targeted, you know, opportunistic, the motive, you know, what's the primary motive here? And obviously one of the key questions that the family have, which is this the work of a number of individuals or is this the work of one person? And that's the key question, that people feel that this case is unresolved and that justice hasn't been done. So
a complicated question and answer.
Yeah, and if our listeners want to follow along with us and want to do their research, what books would you guys recommend that they read or...
Well, I would definitely say to read John Kircher's book because you get a very clear point of view from the family, but also just, you know, how it felt. Things in particular that really moved me, for example, when they were waiting for Meredith's possessions to be repatriated and brought back to them, that instead of them thinking that all her things would return, just this tiny battered suitcase returned with very few possessions in it. And it just really does give you a sense of not just what happened, but for the family, how it's felt being losing their loved one, but them being so vulnerable and almost re-victimized at the end of this, you know, criminal justice system. So I would absolutely recommend John Kircher's book, which I've mentioned a number of times. I'm just trying to find the name of it. So Meredith, Our Daughter's Murder and the Heartbreaking Quest for the Truth.
Mm-hmm. And I think I would also recommend The Forgotten Killer. It was written by John Douglas and Steve Moore and a few other authors. I think that's it's kind of an overview from an investigative and behavioral perspective. But I also think that if you want to go in deeper, because obviously that was a short book that was written actually to help benefit the defense fund. And there is a website that that people have been populating throughout this whole process, the last 9 years now, and it's called Injustice in Perugia. And the thing about that, I know that there are people that think that's a one-sided site and that the other site, there are other sites that claim the opposite and so forth. The reason why I'm suggesting it is because the final judgment that was made was consistent with what was said in Injustice in Perugia and the opposite of what was said on the other website. So I'm suggesting to you that you look at the sites that actually has the same conclusions and shows the experts and the evidence and the different processes that went on that led to the conclusion that the Supreme Court of Italy made their final determination consistent with.
They also had some interesting things to say about Menini and his history and some really interesting facts. I've been enjoying reading a book by Nina Burley, which is called Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox. She moved to Perugia to research the book, and she's got a lot of interesting insights as well. And a book by Ron Hendry, who's also a forensic, and he does a really interesting moment-by-moment forensic examination of the crime scene. Every swipe of blood, every single thing that could possibly have happened in that room, he tries to explain, which is interesting.
He does a forensic crime scene reconstruction, and although I think his expertise was not in murder investigations, his expertise was in doing forensic reconstructions. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really, I mean, it's very, very detailed.
Very.
I read it, and I made some, you know, internal comments about sometimes I thought that he made some assumptions, but in general, I agree that the evidence indicates what he said happened was fairly close to the facts.
Yeah, I dislike that he tries to put thoughts in people's heads. He did that quite a lot, you know, interpreting what somebody was thinking when there's no way he could have known that. But otherwise, I thought it was really interesting how he maps it all out.
So there's lots of interesting things out there. And I also referenced a podcast, which is BBC 4 Report. And there's two of them, one of them called Who Killed Meredith Kircher? And it's by Ruth Alexander. She actually goes to Perugia. She stood at the house. She's explaining what's gone on. She actually talks to, this is in 2014, Raffaele Sollecito and to Guede's lawyer as well. And there's a very experienced forensic scientist, someone called Peter Gill in there, 30 years experience from the UK, talking about the CSI effect. So I would absolutely recommend people to look at that. So we've covered a huge amount and we've still got a lot to go. So we want to take this opportunity to thank our listeners. And we also just want to pay homage as well to the Kirchers, to John Kircher, Arlene, Stephanie, Lyle and John. And this is, again, in Meredith's name. So this is Real Crime Profile signing out. Thank you very much. So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107 or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone, 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357 or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.